When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Joel Cherney. Today, I will be speaking with Henry K. Miller about his book, The First True Hitchcock, The Making of a Filmmaker. The book was published in 2022 by University of California Press. In the book, Miller discusses The Lodger, one of Hitchcock's earliest films. As he mentions, Hitchcock himself considered the silent movie his first true Hitchcock film. We discuss the kind of storytelling and filmmaking methods used in the making of The Lodger and make comparisons to some of his later masterpieces. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Henry K. Miller. Hi, Henry. How are you?
Hi, I'm good, thank you.
Well, I'm talking to Henry K. Miller, the author of the book The First True Hitchcock, The Making of a Filmmaker. The book is scheduled to be published by University of California Press in January of 2022. We're talking about a month before that, but that's good because we're going to have the interview come out right at the time of the release. So this will be some good information for those of you who are interested. And I suspect there's a lot of folks who listen to the New Books in Film podcast who might be interested. I have done a number of Hitchcock-related books, so we can add this to the list. So, Henry, before we talk more about the first true Hitchcock is obviously the film The Lodger, a silent film, and we're going to talk about it in depth, obviously, but I wanted to mention that right up front. And the cover is great. I mean, it literally has a picture from that clearly identifies it pretty well. But before we go into more depth, let's talk a little bit about your background. Obviously, you've been involved in writing and studying film for a long time. What, first off, led you to decide that that was something you wanted to do? And secondly, as we talk, where did you first learn about Hitchcock? Obviously, he died in 1980, but his films are still well-renowned. But what led you to decide that Hitchcock was somebody you wanted to spend more time learning about?
Yes, so I'm in England, and it's possible that he has even more of a profile here. Obviously, he's internationally famous, but even his British films get screened on television. And so I would imagine that the first Hitchcock film I saw would have been something like 39 Steps, because it is just part of the furniture. Having said that, the first film that really made an impact on me was what would now seem to be an obvious choice, was Vertigo, when I was a teenager. I was about 17. And now, of course, that's lauded as the greatest film of all time in famous Sight and Sound poll. But I can't say that was my impression of it at the time. I saw it on television relatively late at night, and I would have come to it through favorable notice in a newspaper, but I wasn't aware of its gargantuan reputation, which it certainly had among film scholars at that time, but I wasn't a film scholar. I'd never been taught film. And I wasn't particularly even a film buff at that point in my late teens. But it did have an overwhelming effect. And when I went to university, I began writing about film. I was becoming more and more interested in it. But in a way, the book didn't come out of a particular passion for Hitchcock. The book came out of a completely different project that I got into when I started doing a PhD almost 10 years later after this exposure. So the book is a strange product of certainly an appreciation of Hitchcock, but also this kind of other project, which is about film culture in Britain, which is the whole realm of in a way of non-mainstream cinema and of critical work of film criticism and of film culture is the arena in which reputations are sustained. This became the subject of my PhD, and Hitchcock's place within it became a chapter of my PhD, and that was the basis for the book. It was a seed out of which the book grew.
So, what was your PhD? Was it film studies or something else?
Yeah, it's a film studies PhD that was about the question of how we came to take film seriously in Britain in the 20s and 30s. And that story, so far as it's been told, it revolves around an institution called the Film Society. It was just called the Film Society because it was the first film society, or at least the first one in the English-speaking world. It was in London, and it was founded by a group of intellectuals in 1925 and attracted other intellectuals, other people who were involved in the film industry as well. And its raison d'etre was to show films that were either going to fall foul of censorship or which couldn't find commercial distribution. And its first program, and it used major cinemas in the West End of London. Its first program was in October 1925. And it lasted until 1939. But over that period, over the course of the 20s and 30s, many provincial film societies were set up in the rest of the country. And during the 1930s, specialized cinemas showing art films, imported art films from Europe on the whole, were established also in London and a few other places. My thesis was actually to try to move away from the film society and talk about what had happened before it. How had, say, the German films that were so important to Hitchcock, how had they come into circulation in Britain? Because the mythology was that it was a responsibility of the film society and therefore of the sort of the social and intellectual elite which the film society represented. What I discovered was a much more complicated picture involving a much more diverse range of actors who contributed to creating this film culture and to the simple task of importing these films. Not so simple, because Germany, of course, we had just fought the Great War against Germany, and so showing German films in the early 1920s was fraught with difficulty, and showing Russian films, Soviet films in the 1920s was almost equally fraught with difficulty. And so the thesis is partly about how those difficulties were surmounted and eventually how these kind of enduring institutions of film culture, like the British Film Institute, came into being. So Hitchcock has, I suppose, there are two ways of talking about Hitchcock in relation to this complex of the British film culture. One is most obviously that Hitchcock has an enormous reputation as a director, and that's partly been sustained by institutions like the BFI and magazines like Sight and Sound, which is published by the BFI. Of course, that's an international story. But Hitchcock's reputation, which I go into in the book, his reputation started quite early. And I think telling that story of how that reputation developed in the 20s and 30s was worth doing. But it's also worth talking about Hitchcock as a product of British film culture or not. He's often written about as somebody who attended the Film Society and came under the influence of German and Russian films while he was at the Film Society. A really big, really important essay for me that sort of led to me doing the PhD was by Peter Wallen, the great Peter Wallen, the late Peter Wallen, who wrote a couple of articles about, a couple of chapters about Hitchcock in his book, Paris Hollywood. And Peter Wallen talks about Hitchcock as having this sort of middlebrow cultural background, kind of West End plays and relatively mainstream novels, including The Lodger, I would guess, that he had this middlebrow background, but through the Film Society, through the kind of his social superiors, I think that the phrase he uses is, through that influence, Hitchcock came to have this kind of modernist edge to him through watching the German films and the Russian films. And it struck me as a very, very, this just struck me as a really important argument, a significant argument, because it keys into a lot of other discussions about British culture in general. It's a question to do with the ownership of culture to some extent. And what I found was that Hitchcock, well, probably hadn't really been exposed to these films at the Film Society, to put it pretty simply. And I don't think that the Russian influence is even especially significant, because he can't have seen the Russian films until after he was well established as a film director. And so the book is a fairly intense look at a year in Hitchcock's life in 1926 and 1927, as he shot The Lodger and then released The Lodger. And that he starts shooting it in February 1926, and it's first shown to the public in January 1927. A lot happens in that period. But one thing that doesn't really happen is his exposure to German films. That must have happened sooner. The Film Society begins in, as I say, October 1925. And so the inspiration for the book is partly a kind of a boring question of dates. He can't have been influenced by the Film Society to make this quintessential Hitchcock film, because the dates don't add up. He must have had this seminal influence of German cinema beforehand, and which he could easily have done, because the German films were commercially released in Britain in the early to mid 1920s. So films like The Last Laugh and The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and Dr. Mabuse, these really important films were shown in ordinary cinemas, and that must be where he saw them.
So obviously, how many silent films do we know for sure that he made? I know that The Lodger is definitely one of the most lauded from the period, and I know he was the one who called it his first true Hitchcock film, so when we talk about that as part of the title of the book, that's directly from him. So what came before, and what do we have anything left of anything before The Lodger?
I'm going to say that he made 9 silent films, but I would have to check. I'm not doing the mental arithmetic. So The Lodger is his 3rd film. He's made 2 films before The Lodger. And again, the reason it's the first true Hitchcock from his point of view is that he felt he was very much invested in the story, and that it had a lot of quintessentially Hitchcockian themes and sort of stylistic moves are there in The Lodger. But he had made 2 films beforehand, The Pleasure Garden and The Mountain Eagle. And they were both shot in and around Germany in 1925. There's a small studio, not even that small, there's a studio near Munich that these productions were based at. Quite a lot of it was filmed on location. Some of them, some of The Pleasure Garden was filmed in Italy. And The Mountain Eagle, it's slightly vague where it was filmed. It says they were filmed in the Tyrol, which could well mean Italy, or it could mean Austria. But The Pleasure Garden survives, and it was relatively well regarded when it came out. It's not that there's a lot of sort of falsehoods out there about how it was only The Lodger that turned Hitchcock into a success, and that isn't true. So The Pleasure Garden is a story of kind of 2 London showgirls, and it has thriller elements to it, and there are plenty of aspects that you could easily say point to it being a true Hitchcock movie, but it just has never had that reputation. And also, it's been very difficult to see The Pleasure Garden in its original state. It was restored from a kind of a multiple number of prints, getting on for 10 years ago by the BFI. But even that kind of restored version hasn't been shown very widely. It's not on Blu-ray, for example. But The Mountain Eagle is another story again. The Mountain Eagle is it's a Western. It's set in the US. It must have been a very snowy Western winter time, like McCabe and Mrs. Miller, except we have no idea because it doesn't survive. It was shown in 1927. And it was shown in, it, 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 you know, it, it yeah, it wasn't junked or anything, but it didn't open in the West End of London, and that makes quite a difference. It didn't. That means that its distributor didn't really have faith in it. On the whole, we don't have that. Actually, that's not recorded. We don't know why it didn't have a West End opening, but it didn't. And so it was. I mean, I think you'd have to say that it was dumped, and it didn't get good reviews at the time. So we have no idea about. We have no really strong idea about the Mountain Eagle. It seems to have a wrong man plot. So again, that points to the future of Hitchcock as well. So actually, when he made The Lodger, when he started shooting it, he was still a very young man. He was 26 years old, but he had already shot two films, and one of them, The Pleasure Garden, opened in the West End during the time that he was shooting The Lodger in March and April 1926, and got a decent set of reviews. So the title of the book, First Drew Hitchcock, slightly teasing in some ways. His career, as the book shows, may well have found success anyway. But I think his nostalgia for The Lodger is extremely interesting.
Well, and as you've pointed out, BFI has been working hard to restore and get everything out. In fact, I don't know if the I'm not sure whether do you folks over in England have access to the Criterion Channel? I know it's in the United States, but I don't know if it's over there. But they have a huge number of the BFI restorations of the early films that they on their streaming, and then of course, as you point out, available on DVD. So people here can watch The Lodger in its pristine format, and then it's got some of the documentary material that was also on the Criterion Blu-ray. But so you get it. It's really great that, and a lot of these other Hitchcock films from the period are available on there. And it's just, and it says right at the beginning as part of the BFI restoration project.
That's really interesting. No, we don't.
I was afraid of that, but that's why I have to be careful sometimes when I talk about streaming services, because it can be different from one place to the next, and that makes a big difference.
No, it's madly frustrating, actually. So some of those films, some of the silent films are actually all available, as I say, but not the restored versions. The Lodger, we do have that on Blu-ray, but not on Criterion Blu-ray, because again, it's region locked, and anyway, that kind of thing. But no, that yeah, but more broadly. The Lodger has continued to have this presence in film culture through things like official releases, like the Criterion Blu-ray 4 or 5 years ago. That really does make quite a difference when that happens, when a film gets a push like that. But also the Lodger gets shown, it gets projected. Considering it's a silent British film, it gets shown relatively often. I've seen it a number of times on the big screen over the course of years, just because it does get shown that even before the BFI restoration program. But it is, you know, that all of these films have been greatly improved. So that's an interesting reversal, that now they're better, they're more available in the US than in England, because the reverse was true for a long time. I would say that the Lodger was actually released in the United States in 1928. But it didn't. His reputation in the U.S. only really begins with The Man Who Knew Too Much and The 39 Steps in the mid 1930s. But back home in England, he's kind of one of the leading film directors in the industry, so a very well known figure.
Well, what's interesting is obviously he started filmmaking at the tail end, basically, of the silent era. I mean, he, as you point out, he made a number of films, but in the end, the silent era ends 29-30, around that period of time, and he continues on pretty quickly. So this definitely probably is a perfect example of a silent film from him. What I found in, and I'm not an expert on silent film, I've seen a lot of them, so I'm not sure how many of the things that he did in the film are unusual for silent film, or that's just normal. For example, the title cards are completely stylized. blinking and all kinds of things that clearly show that he was attempting to make use of any visual material to help tell his story.
Ah, I'm glad you raised them, because you mentioned the cover of the book earlier, which I'm extremely pleased and proud to have. So the cover is what was a rejected poster for the Lodger by the American graphic designer E. McKnight Cowper. So he was an American who moved to England before the First World War, has a very high reputation as a designer. There was a big, beautiful book of his work was published just quite recently, actually, by in association with an exhibition at organized by Cooper Union in New York City. And Cowper was very highly regarded at the time in the 20s by the Bloomsbury set, and by particularly by the art critic Roger Fry. And so Cowper was enlisted in the first instance to do these title cards for the Lodger, and they are unusual and unusually good ones. Part of the story of the Lodger, and again why the title of the first Drew Hitchcock is slightly ironic, is that we don't know, right? So the big myth around the Lodger is that the studio hated it. I mean, Hitchcock says this himself. This is a myth that comes from Hitchcock's own mouth. Studio saw it, hated it, put it on the shelf, did, in his words, one or two things to it, and then it got released, and then the critics loved it, and from then on his career was assured. That's largely a myth. But one thing that did happen was the commissioning of E. McKnight Cowper to do these titles doesn't seem to have involved Hitchcock. The person who seems to have pushed for E. McKnight Cowper was Ivor Montague, the chairman of the London Film Society, who is a young highbrow, who would have had various connections into the Bloomsbury world. And so Cowper came along and did these titles. They look kind of, you'd say that they look kind of Germanic, which is appropriate for this film, which is certainly has some influence of the German expressionist cinema. And some of them are animated. So they make this a really distinctive and important film. And then after it was shown to the critics and to the film trade, Cowper was commissioned to do a poster for it, but the distributor then rejected this poster and said, no, you're making it look like it's a highbrow German film, and that's not where we want to go with this. We want this to be a successful movie. Apparently the poster was put up on display at the cinema where the film was shown. But it's now in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art in New York. The titles. But we don't have any hard evidence for Hitchcock's. We don't know either way what Hitchcock thought about these titles, but clearly they're very good. And Hitchcock, of course, his start in the industry was in designing titles. So you can only really speculate about what he might have thought about them.
Of course, for anybody who hasn't seen the film yet or don't know about as much, obviously we're talking about what we today would call a serial killer who is terrifying the streets of London, killing blonde women, is what the basic beginning is. And in fact, it starts right with one of the latest killings. And obviously, by starting so strongly, it definitely makes the film distinctive in that sense. I mean, you know, and we would see that in later Hitchcock films and other directors too do that, where they immediately start the action and then back off. And so right at the beginning, we get this shot, and then it builds right into the idea that back then, especially the newspapers and how they were so important in drumming up controversy and action and to get their own papers sold. And that was one of the early scenes I saw that really got me. Was there's a shot where all of the, you know, I think it's in the newspaper office, and it's like four layers going on at the same time of action, and you can see them all. And even though it's a static shot, the movement and everything going on there really, to me, right from the beginning, it grabs you as far as its great use of movement.
Yes, I mean, we don't think about Hitchcock as being a political filmmaker with good reason, I think. But this opening sequence, which is extraordinary, what it shows, and this is a sequence he was very proud of. The sequence shows the immediate afterworld. It shows the murder, essentially, and then the discovery of the body, and then the leaking of the news, or the transmitting of the news of this murder across the city mostly by newspapers, but also by the new medium of radio and these kind of illuminated scrolling signs like you'd see in Piccadilly Circus. And none of the major characters in the film are in this early sequence. It's remarkable. It's kind of a montage sequence. So this is a part of the point of saying that he wasn't influenced by the Russians. Is that, well, how did he come to make this montage sequence? But yes, it does show the power of the press, and it shows it's filmed on location at the offices of the Evening Standard, which is one of the major London newspapers. And Hitchcock's first ever cameo in one of his own films, which of course is what another reason why this is the first true Hitchcock, is that he makes this cameo. He is playing an editor at the newspaper, kind of directing the processes of the newspaper, which I think is interesting if you want to think about film as a medium of manipulation, and of course newspapers as a medium of manipulation, because what happens is that people are terrified of the serial, I mean, of course they would be, but people get terrified of the serial killer. So the blonde women are wearing dark wigs and so on.
Yeah, he told so much of the story visually, obviously, because there was no audio. And it just shows right from the beginning that, in a way, his initial work in silent films helped him because he had to tell his story visually with minimal amounts of text. So some of these early scenes, you know what's going on. It's pretty obvious going from start to finish that this is the story from the kill. And, of course, he plays around with time and everything. Obviously, it doesn't go to the newspaper that quickly. But literally from the minute the murder is found out to the latest murder, until it comes out in the newspapers and gets transmitted, he shows how quickly it spread is. And it, clearly we've been put right in the middle of the story too, because at this point there'd been prior murders. So anyway, I found that just right from the beginning, how audacious, I'm going to use that word because I think it's a fair one, the way he showed it. Now, obviously, as we say, it's based on the storyline is of a unknown killer. And then soon after, the lodger played by Ivor Novello, who obviously he did another film with Hitchcock later, but he obviously must have been a well-known British actor at the time, since he gets his name above the title.
Yeah, Ivor Novello is he certainly was a very famous actor. He came to prominence as a songwriter with Keep the Home Fires Burning, which was an anthem of the First World War. And then he was really a central figure in part of the West End demi-monde, let's put it that way, that he was a writer, but also a performer. And so involved in lots of West End productions, which aren't necessarily plays, they'll be kind of review shows. And then he goes into movies, and some of his, he's in film directed by D.W. Griffith. He's in French films as well. And I wouldn't, on having said that, I don't know if he was really cutting through until he co-wrote a play called The Rat, and then starred in a film of it. And The Rat, he plays, this is in 1924, he plays a hoodlum of the French underworld who, they were called Apaches. And you'll kind of see them in other facets of 1920s culture in general, movies and plays. And the Rat was something that he co-wrote with his friend Constance Collier, who's another kind of West End figure, who she eventually, you know, she's an actress sometimes, and she's in Hitchcock's The Rope a long time, not The Rope, in Rope, a long time later. But anyway, he writes this play called The Rat, co-writes a play called The Rat, and he gets laughed out of town by the critics. The idea of Novello as a kind of a ruffian, because he's not at all, he's sort of a very handsome, smooth-looking guy. The critics find the entire thing a concoction, but he has a very, very loyal audience, not of perhaps traditional theatre goers, but rather of film goers, and especially women film goers. So they go to this, they flock to see this play, The Rat. It doesn't open in the West End, it opens in Brighton, I think to make a point that he doesn't rely on the fashionable West End audience. And then that gets turned into a film in 1925 by Hitchcock's, well, I've used the word mentor in the book, and maybe it's a tricky one. Hitchcock came up in the industry as the assistant to a director called Graham Cutts, or Jack Graham Cutts, his name changes. And Hitchcock always bad-mouthed Cutts in later interviews, Hitchcock and Alma Revel, who was also Hitchcock's wife, who was also part of the filmmaking team at the studio that Cutts was the chief director at Gainsborough. And all this is a bit rough on Cutts, but he directed Novello in The Rat in 1925, and it was a sensationally successful film. And it was kind of after this that Novello was cast in The Lodger. So yeah, he was probably the biggest male star in British cinema. But at the same time, he kind of harbored ambitions to be taken seriously as a stage actor primarily, and his fame probably is largely confined to these aisles. His name lives on. There's a songwriting award each year, the Ivor Novello Award. That's still a big deal. So he kind of has this presence, which the others in the film do not.
Right. I know that it's clear that Hitchcock figured out right from the beginning he was going to have to at least somewhat disguise his as you say, his charisma and everything, because we first see him walking in, all covered up, and so you can tell that right from the beginning Hitchcock figures is able to make him a mysterious figure and such. But before we go to, I'm not trying to go all over the place, although we're already talking about parts of the beginning. I want to back up a little bit. As one of the things that I find interesting whenever I talk to someone about a particular film in particular, is what kind of sources did you use to pull together a lot of your information? I mean, obviously you were able to detail in pretty good amount the making and some of the issues at the time the film was made and released. So what kind of sources were you able to find to help you with this?
Mostly, I mean, this book has been a long time in the writing. Mostly, I get my information by going through old newspapers. And when I started the book, that was a process that was really going through them page by page, or scrolling through a microfilm page by page. Which is laborious, not very much fun, but you get, not only do you get information that's not out there, but it's also it's quite useful to get a kind of a flavor of the times through newspapers. You see what else is going on, and you start to make connections, and it probably did influence the way that I wrote the book, that the book does try and situate Hitchcock in post-war England. So that was the main source, would have been them. And of course, over time, newspapers have continue to be digitized and made searchable online. And some of the major ones, the Times and the Guardian, were done probably they became available to me anyway, 10 years ago or so. But vastly more is done all the time. And even it's literally in the last week of writing the book, one of the major British film trade newspapers. So there were four weekly newspapers covering the film trade. They're all quite substantial paper objects. The major one of them, Kinematograph Weekly, was put online by the British Library, about a year ago. Which, if that had happened earlier, it would have made my life easier, but also kind of a lot more sedentary and boring. I quite like going to libraries and not just looking through stuff online. But yeah, primarily newspapers, but there were some archive, some quite important archival discoveries that were the, I guess, the genesis for the book. Archive discoveries that contradicted what we thought that we knew about Hitchcock.
I am a retired librarian from Cleveland, and I was in public libraries. And of course, way back then when I started, and I don't even know what the status of any of it is now since I'm long away from there, but we had a newspaper room. And literally early on, it was mostly just bound or loose newspapers. And then eventually things started to get microfilmed. So it wasn't unusual to walk in and see people going through old newspapers, you know, literally page by page through a microfilm machine or sometimes even paper. And of course, depending on what they were studying, and especially Cleveland, these may have been the only copies of some of these newspapers that were even available. So I do understand that fully. And I'll be honest, I've used some of the digitized newspapers online, which show the full pages. And to me, I find that a little bit difficult to work with, but maybe it's because I just don't have a lot of experience doing it. But I fully understand what the process was like for what you were doing. What made you, I mean, and I know we're sort of talking backwards, but that's okay. What made you to choose the Lodger to be the topic of your study? I know we talked a lot about that it was a PhD study, but it started that way. It's part of your PhD, it then built off, but what struck you about the Lodger that you felt was a very good example to use?
It was because of the story. I didn't choose the Lodger. I didn't exactly choose it on its strengths as a film, although I think that with the possible exception of The Manxman, it is his, you know, it is his best silent film. But my impetus for writing didn't really come through that at all. It was quite the thing that led me to write about it was more to do with the story that is usually told about the making of The Lodger, which my initial impetus was discovering that this story, which Hitchcock tells himself on many occasions, and it's in all of the books about Hitchcock. It continues to be repeated over and over again. It was my discovery that this story was 90% wrong. That led me to try to tell a different story about Hitchcock, to try and find out what had really happened. So that story is this one of the film being hated by the, you know, rejected by the studio, who, a couple of changes being made, and then it going on to great success. I mean, that is what the story is. And even if you say it out loud, it sounds slightly murky. And what I discovered was an extremely complex, extremely complex reality, but at the bottom of which was most of that not being true. It has to be kind of unfolded over the length of the book. But there were materials in the archive that helped me, or, you know, that cast a doubt on the story, and there was definite information in the newspapers as well. So the story in the form told by Ivan Montagu, who's the chairman of the Film Society, who was brought in to help edit it, he says it wasn't just that the Lodger was rejected by the studio. His two earlier films were also being held up. They hadn't been released, and Hitchcock had made three films, therefore, that had not been released, and that, you know, he's a young man and his career was in the balance. And so Montague's intervention, his re-editing of the film, not only saved the Lodger, but it also saved Hitchcock's career. And oddly, that's already quite a big kind of inflated claim, but oddly, the claim gets kind of ever more inflated through publication. And so that Montagu, not only does he re-edit it, but he brings the influence of Sergei Eisenstein to bear on the film and things like this, because later on Montagu had an association with Eisenstein. So the impetus was, it's not necessarily a noble aim, but the initial impetus was to try and was kind of to debunk the story, but eventually it became to tell a different story and to tell what I think is a more truthful story, where that involves having a much wider perspective on how Hitchcock became Hitchcock, and how the course of his career developed. It's not such an underdog story, but it has kind of quite, I would say, quite unexpected twists and turns nevertheless.
So obviously one of the stories, and you talk about this right in the introduction, you start to pull out some of the things right from the beginning, and the idea that the film was shelved by the studio and suddenly wasn't going to be shown, and then suddenly the studio made some changes and then they released it and everybody liked it. That's the initial story that you talk about right from the very beginning. And clearly, as you're pointing out, there's the story itself is not, you know, there's more to the story than that basics. It almost sounds like they're saying they saved Hitchcock, the studio did, right from the beginning, when that turns out not really to be the case.
Yeah. The story is, yeah, the more you delve into the story, the more iffy it sounds, which is why I delved into it. So the story is that the studio didn't like it, and so they brought in Ivor Montague to do the re-edit. And Ivor Montague, who's barely out of university, he runs this film society that shows highbrow films. And so the idea is mostly Ivor Montague's version of the story that we have. He says, oh, it was on the logic of, you know, send a thief to catch a thief. They thought this film is too highbrow, therefore we'll bring in this really highbrow guy and he'll fix the problem. But in a way, I think the reason that story kind of takes hold and catches, and like I say, you know, this isn't an obscure, I'm not picking a fight with a kind of obscure argument in an old book. This always gets rehashed in documentaries about Hitchcock. I think it's because it's a silent film, it's a British film, it's from a very long time ago. And when most books about Hitchcock get written, it's kind of, this is building up to the main event, which is obviously his beloved Hollywood films. And I don't resent that, because I think those films do have a more general appeal. But if you decide to focus in on what happened in the 1920s, what really happened, then these kinds of stories, which these kind of slightly improbable stories that we do enjoy when it comes to writing about film, you have to look past the improbable stories. But they get, I mean, it's a fairly normal part of, I would say, about film history. Just the other day, to give an example, there was an interview, this went viral on, or you know, it went fairly viral on Twitter. There was an interview with Mel Brooks. And, you know, he tells a great anecdote about how did you get away with such and such in a film in Blazing Saddles. And he said, oh, well, what I did was when the studio boss was upset with what I'd done, I just said yes to him in the moment and then didn't follow up. I didn't go through with it. So the boss would say, you've got to cut that. You've got to cut that line. You can't have it. And Mel Brooks would say, yeah, I'll do it. And then just not do it because, you know, the studio boss has got a lot on his plate. And there are similar stories. I mean, there are similar stories, I think, about Hitchcock and Psycho. But anyway, we all love those stories and they're great fun. And there must be, you know, usually a grain of truth in them. But I think really there's probably a little bit more to them. And that's kind of what I was doing with the Hitchcock story here, was to spoil people's fun.
One of the other interesting things to me early on was how involved right from the start is at the time girlfriend, fiance, but then later wife, Alma. She was always important to his film life and actually, obviously, real life. And right from the beginning, what did she bring to the whole process?
With this one, I mean, so she. It's a good question, because I think it's one of the answers to it needs to be explored in more depth. She was his assistant director on The Lodger and also on the previous two films. Her background, she had quite like a lot of people who entered the industry in the 1910s, she had quite a wide variety of experience in the film business. She joins the film business before Hitchcock in the mid-1910s when she's still, you know, a teenager. She lives near a film studio at Twickenham, and which is a suburb of London. And so she even acts at one point. So her main experience, though, and what she specializes in, is editing. But it's a bit more. There's more to it than that. It's that she will be on the set as in doing continuity, which means she has to observe everything that's going on and make sure that there is continuity between shots. And so, of course, any scene in a film will be made up of a number of different shots, and we need to make sure that the actors are in the same positions from one shot to the next, and that if they've got a drink, that it needs to be at the right level between shots, and all these kind of famous things that you notice if you pay too much attention, and obviously more important things like their costume and hair and so on, because you might shoot you might shoot the rest of the scene on a different day. So her role is being on set, observing that, and also she's involved in the editing of the film as well. And I think that that's part of what she is bringing to the Lodger. We don't have any information there's no credit for who did the initial editing of the Lodger. And I think the assumption has to be that it's Alma Revel, probably, and Alfred Hitchcock, but there is cut footage from the film which is shown to a journalist while the film is still being shot, before Ivan Montague's involvement. And of course, the idea is that when the film is first shown to the studio, they don't like it, so a film has to exist. So I strongly assume that that's her role on it. And when Ivan Montague does make his changes to the film, one of the things that led me to write what I wrote was a piece of communication from very late, very, very late in the editing, which refers to Miss Revel being the kind of the point person for the editing of the film. Ivan Montague has an intermediary who is in touch with Alma Revel about the editing of the film. So I would assume that that's her primary responsibility. But of course, also she's a film writer, and she has credits on numerous Hitchcock films as a writer, and you assume that she's in the mix, certainly when the film is being conceptualized. So always on all of his films, a completely central figure, and so yeah, he proposes to her about 2 months before the Lodger starts shooting, and they get married a couple of months after its first screening.
So obviously back then, I mean, I don't know, this is one of those things about silent movies and the movie industry at the time. Obviously, as we've already pointed out, it got very good reviews when it came out. Did he get mentioned? Did Hitchcock himself get mentioned in the reviews for his skill in directing? I mean, I don't know what the reviews would have been like back for silent films, whether the technical folks and the other, you know, people who were behind the cameras, whether they received the kind of accolades that nowadays is normal.
Yeah, they absolutely did. I think one of the strangest myths about our perception of film criticism and film culture is that, you know, Cahiers du Cinéma, the French critics of the 50s, kind of almost invented the idea of the auteur as the director as author, which is, I don't know, it's just about as wrong as you can be. And so the director's name would be used for publicity purposes, even in the 1920s in some cases. And so that's true for Hitchcock. When his first film, The Pleasure Garden, opens in April 1926, there are adverts saying it's by Britain's youngest director. And there's precedent for this, especially with Cecil B. DeMille, who Hitchcock very much admired. So, yeah, the director's skill was frequently noticed. Hitchcock was seen as very promising, actually, even before anybody had seen much of his films. You know, he's Alfred Hitchcock, of whom much is expected, is a phrase that I think turns up in more than one article about the making of the film. He was friendly with some film critics, and so they all discuss him and his, even to some extent, his persona. Ivor Montague was also, apart from many other things, he was a film critic for The Observer. And, you know, he writes in his review of The Pleasure Garden, Hitchcock said his best when he's showing a world that he knows, which is kind of lower middle class London family. And so for Montague to have written that, he had some sense of the director's persona. Of course, he didn't have the full Hitchcock persona of later decades as a practical joker and so on. But no, for sure, Hitchcock's skill, his stylistic choices, these are noticed by critics in the 1920s.
And there is just so much about the film that, you know, now we can look at it and say, of course, this must be. You can see why it would be considered to be such a classic early Hitchcock film, because of we have the wrong man concept. We have the person getting into more and more trouble and being saved at the last minute and all kinds of things like that that become normal. I know it's not the film was based on a book. How much changes were made to make the film, or did some of that come through from the original book?
A lot of changes, and it's a fascinating development, I would say. The novel by Mary Belloc-Lowndes is told very much from the point of view of a landlady who takes in this lodger who she starts to suspect is a serial killer. So the basic situation is there. But the difference is partly that in the book she doesn't tell anyone because she doesn't. This is a slightly cartoonish version. She doesn't tell anyone because she doesn't want to lose the income. I mean, it's a consideration because she's not sure he's a serial killer, and the novel is almost entirely set within the house. And not to give it away, but in the book, he really is the serial killer. It's pretty obvious that he's a serial killer, and so it proves to be. And so the film is inspired by the novel, but it's also inspired by a play, a version of the novel that Hitchcock said he saw in 1915 or 1916. It was a West End play, and it was inspired by the novel, but it's a comedy. It's very, very different from the novel in lots and lots of ways. And so the film is a strange three-way split between the novel, the play, and inventions that come from Hitchcock and his screenwriter, Elliot Stannard. And some of those are the most interesting, from the point of view of Hitchcock studies, kind of the most interesting things in it. So one thing it anticipates is Rebecca and Vertigo, which that's not in the novel or the play. This idea of a young woman being kind of made over to look like another woman, but I can't say any more because of spoilers. But that's in the film, and it's not in the source material. It has to come from Hitchcock and Stannard, or possibly Alma Revel.
Well, and of course, so much of it is like any film. It's in the visual aspect of how you present the material, obviously. Right from the beginning, the first time we see the lodger, he is clearly being shown as being sinister. And even in later scenes where we finally see him smile a little bit and seem less, you know, calm down a little bit, there's always the strange stuff. He's got things locked up. Nobody knows what's there. And then, of course, we have the later on in the scenes where certain things get explained and he completely changes, you know, into a more sympathetic character because of why he supposedly is where he is. So all of these things shows, you know, Hitchcock clearly disguising the character as best as he can until he gets to a point where he wants to go to the next step of the story.
Yes. I mean, I think it's okay to say that it's, in lots of respects, quite a crude performance, or quite, sometimes quite a jarring performance, the way it goes from kind of could be a murderer to seeming totally unthreatening. But that does sort of anticipate Rebecca as well, where Laurence Olivier's character is this brooding, Byronic, romantic figure who, again, the question is well, it's a very similar scenario where in the novel he actually is a murderer. the brooding, and the brooding comes from that, and his secret is that he is a murderer. And they have to fudge it in, it's pretty quite an English expression, but they have to fudge that in the film of Rebecca, so that he's not quite a murderer. It's kind of it's okay what he did. But in The Lodger, there's no way that he can be a murderer. So you have to have a totally transformed ending. And so Novello has to be not a murderer. And that's from the play. I have to say, Hitchcock would tell the story that, well, we couldn't have Ivan Novello be the murderer. That couldn't work. From a censorship point of view, you can't have a murderer getting away with it. And so he was complaining about that, I suppose, in interviews. But like I say, that's how it is in the play as well. So it's not. So I don't know. I think he might have been perfectly satisfied with the ending at the time. We'll never know.
Although it's funny that it's probably the least satisfying part of the film, as far as I'm concerned, the fact that the killer, the actual murderer, gets captured off screen. We only know it because somebody says, oh, they caught him. Oh, I mean, it's like that is, you know, I'm not sure where that came from in the overall storyline, but maybe it goes back to the play where it would be virtually impossible to show it if on a stage, unless the murderer just happened to show up to the house, but to the boarding house. But it is sort of strange. It's a strange way to do it, I found. And like I say, I would consider it to be the least satisfying part of the film, but that's not really Hitchcock, where unless it was somehow they had to come right out and show that he wasn't, and that's how they did it. It was just like, what? It's easy to miss.
I agree. I mean, I think having the murderer caught off screen and that's to some extent, I do find that to be a kind of, that's Hitchcock's sense of humor, I would say. And also, what, you know, if you look at that scene in detail, what happens is there's a big crowd of people who are going to lynch the lodger because they think he's a murderer, and then they're persuaded to stop. And the reason they stop is not because the police are saying don't do it, it's because one of the newspaper boys comes along with a new edition of the Evening Standard, which says, we found the actual murderer. And so the public trusts the newspapers more than the police. And I think that's also part of, it's also a kind of Hitchcock joke. You should always remember that he doesn't, I mean, his actual comedies are not funny, I would say. Mr. and Mrs. Smith and Trouble with Harry, I can't really get on with them at all. But he does have a sense of humor, and that's sort of what it is. But the really most grim bit is the right at the end, after the climax of the film, which is that which is kind of from the play, which is the lodger turns out to be an aristocrat with one of these kind of very movie big houses. It would be impossible to have a house of this scale in central London. But this house seems to look over, kind of overlooks Big Ben and the Thames and whatnot. And the landlord and lady, I think it's suggested that they're sort of an impoverished landlord and lady, but they're rescued by becoming the servants of their former lodger, and their daughter becomes, you know, his girlfriend or bride. It's as an ending, it's a bit like Suspicion 15 years later, that's a Cary Grant, Joan Fontaine movie, which has a lot of similarities with The Lodger. Which, yeah, is just one of those famous, that's a disappointing ending movies.
Yeah, unfortunately, as you point out, this is the kind of thing that Hitchcock deals with his entire career. I recently, or recent, about a year ago now, I think, interviewed Mark Lanzi, who wrote a book on Cary Grant, and he talks a lot about Suspicion and how it was made and some of the issues and such, and including that kind of thing. And it clearly shows that Hitchcock continued to run into these kind of issues, especially during the period of the time, you know, his major period, at least until we get into the late 50s, where things get changed and redone. And unfortunately, he runs into issues both with studios and censor boards and so on. And I think even the idea back then that he couldn't, that Ivor Novello couldn't be the murderer because, and get away with it. And some of those changes, I suspect, were related to all that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know whether it was precisely for reasons of censorship, but yeah, the play also couldn't countenance having the murderer get away with it. And the stage plays were even more subject to censorship. Rather, it was a more official system of censorship in force on the stage through the Lord Chamberlain's office. But anyway, yeah, the same thing had afflicted the play. But rather than botch the ending of the play just presents itself as being largely an out and out comedy. In the play, it's not very important who the murderer is. Film is, it's a more complicated hybrid. It is actually interested in, it is a thriller, and it is meant to be this, the prospect of the serial killer coming back is meant to be, you know, scary, which is not really the case with the play.
Well, we've talked for over an hour now, and I feel like we've still only scratched the surface of the book. I think there's no question, and in addition to trying to get rid of some of the myths about this particular film, which also helps with some of the other myths about Hitchcock, I think it's a great description of the making of the film, and which is an interesting thing all by itself, given that while much of the film takes place in a set piece, a couple of rooms in a rooming house, the outdoor scenes, almost all at night, add to the mood of the entire film, and I think it just proves how well Hitchcock could understand from the beginning how to get suspense and other kinds of important things that would go throughout his career. I hope that when the book comes out, it gets looked at by Hitchcock people. It's gotten some good, very good early reviews, which is great. And I just think it's just one more great book. I mean, it seems like I think I said this to some other author about their Hitchcock book. I says, could we have another Hitchcock book? And here's another one. And yet you found something that was worthwhile writing about that hadn't been written about before. And I think it just proves that there's plenty of other writing out there and information. And as hopefully people will follow some of your tracks and check some of the sources that you used. And that's one of the reasons why I always ask about sources. So as I say, I hope the book does well, as I say, and I really appreciate the time you spent with me about it. The book, as we've said, is The First True Hitchcock, The Making of a Filmmaker by Henry K. Miller, who I've been speaking with, for University of California Press. It's scheduled for release in early January of 2022. But as I say, I hope people will reach out for it. And I really want to thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed being here.
Thank you. My great thanks to Henry for his time. The Lodger is available in a variety of locations for viewing, and I hope you will take the time to watch it. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network.